Hi, welcome to Connecting the Dots, the podcast where we share our stories from the battlefield of consulting. I'm your host, Johnny Hill.
I'm Sarah Slate.
Hi, I'm Ted Wilmes.
Hey, I'm Chris LaCava.
Hey, I'm Kareem Jamal.
Today we're talking all about the last stage in the product lifecycle, and that's when it's time to sunset a product and transition into something new. Let's get started. So before we jump into specifically like the end of life for a product and what that can look like, let's start by just talking about the overall life cycle of a product.
Yeah. So classically, product life cycle has four, sometimes five stages. It starts with like the introduction stage, which is, you know, a lot of times in the startup world, that's where like guerrilla marketing and guerrilla sales comes in. You're just trying to get your brand out there. Then there's a period of growth and sales and revenue starts to kick up. And then there's a maturity stage where things stabilize and kind of plateau. And then there's a decline stage. So a lot of times when, you know, business types and product managers talk about product lifecycle, they're usually thinking about the product being in one of those four stages and maybe transitioning. And then the other thing that people are often worried about is slowing down the product as it moves through some of those phases. For example, a lot of times you want to keep a product in the maturity phase and prevent it from going to the decline phase. And mm-hmm. So there's a bunch of things that you can do there. You can adjust the price, or you can, a lot of times there's a lot of marketing campaigns around making things nostalgic. So they never get into that decline category. But the quantitative part of this is a lot of people are always looking at pricing strategies and the demand curve and trying to basically attenuate to that demand. And doing that is the main tactic that product managers often use to keep into one of these phases if they want to lock in maturity as long as possible, for example, before they go into decline. Hmm. But as they go into decline, you have to have a plan to land the plane. And that's kind of where end of lifing a product comes in.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious because I feel like, you know, that's probably a healthy understanding of like in general, but I mean, are there often exceptions to that? Or is it like, that's the most common kind of bell curve you'll see is the kind of what you described, Chris? Like, because I'm sure everyone has thoughts of like, oh, well, Microsoft Word's been around forever, but there have been versions of it that have been released and they've kind of, you know, and I'm sure you could say they've lost users on some of those transitions, but a lot of people would say like, well, that wasn't the end of life. That was just like the end of a version. Is that different? Is that the same thing?
I mean, that's a really good example of a product that's had a really good run. And some of them do have, you know, runs for hundreds and hundreds of years. But I think if you really look at any of those products, you know, that have been in that maturity section for a long time, what you're really seeing is that product is modernizing and reinventing to stay there before it goes to decline. And even things that are like super classic, that are kind of perennial and don't get out of that maturity category, they still have to innovate. So therefore, like if you see a product kind of in stasis, it's still having to like, you know, work on the latest operating systems in the case of Word, or, you know, right. Now they're adding like, you know, chatbots and into Microsoft Office and things like that. So it's still innovating. And I would argue like, it's kind of a different product than it was 2 years ago, 5 years ago, mm-hmm. whatever the major release cadence is.
It depends on what you call or define as a product, right? Because like the overarching umbrella Word or Excel are still there even after all these years. But during each sort of upgrade cycle or transition in these innovation periods, if you look closely, there's probably a handful and dozens of features that have been sunset, right? So part of the product really has been sunset while they introduce new ones. Just it's the massive product, so you don't even notice that much, really.
There's a distinction between like the product and the brand. The brand has stayed the same. And, you know, there are also cases of rebranding or mergers that kind of change things. But like, yeah, I think that's a fair argument. Like the brand has stayed consistent, but the product has shifted over time, even in like, you know, kind of modern versions where it's all cloud based and like there's little incremental updates. There's still constantly things changing. It's just a lot less like, oh, it's the 2011 release. Okay, now it's the 2012 release. Often it's like, you know, it's release 73578B and it downloaded automatically and you don't even know it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this comes down to, do you want to acknowledge the pedigree of the product or do you want to make it distinct as something else when you see a lot of those like reinventions and innovations? Sometimes it's like, this is a bigger, better, faster, more modern Microsoft Word, but it's still Microsoft Word. You don't have to retrain, and it's got all the quality that you expect from Microsoft Word, whatever that is. and then there's other things where it's like, that thing was broken and it couldn't go any further, and from the ashes will rise, you know, whatever, WordPerfect or whatever the next word processor is going to be.
Right. And Microsoft Word might not be the fairest example of when you're talking about sunsetting a product or needing to change. Like, I think most anyone would want to be in that situation where you're that well known as a product, but a lot of other products are, you know, fighting for market share, fighting for attention, and having to solve this problem in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, Word is more of sort of a continuous modernization where it has many sunsets throughout and many sunrises for that matter.
Yeah, I think most products, I guess, like probably most businesses maybe don't even make it to the maturity stage ever. Probably, you know, they're going straight to sunset almost, you know, just because it takes so much to even get into that position to take a startup to be at the point where you're able to actually even mature something. So and I feel like the early sunset is much different than the late post-maturity sunset. The early sunsetting is usually very quick. And there's many of the things that we'll probably talk about on sunsetting we don't have the luxury of happening.
Yeah, on that note, let's get a little bit into it. So, I mean, I think sunset might be kind of a technical term, or end of lifing. I mean, it's fairly self-explanatory, but we're talking about when a product has reached that point where it's time to say goodbye and do something new. Just to clarify, in case that's a little bit too technical. So let's talk about a little bit, like, what are the reasons behind why that may need to happen?
Sometimes it's a business decision to reach another segment. Like your, this could be brand related, it could be technology platform related, but for whatever reason, there are constraints from you. You have a solution, or maybe you've built a business that's known for a set of capabilities, but you can't move into another segment with the product that you have. So you have to transition or add something to your product line. But since we're talking about end of lifing it, maybe how you ramp down that product and how you ramp up another one is just to get to a new segment.
Sometimes it's because despite your best efforts, you just can't sort of break that ceiling and get enough market share to be worth it, right? Like in the browsers war, there are a few main ones and others haven't been able to break through and get enough share. And so at some point they decide, hey, it's not worth it anymore. And they just sunset it.
I mean, sometimes it's just technology, you know, the operating system that you're working on is end-of-lifing, or the demographics or fads have changed in such a way that your product's, you know, just not viable and you've got to pivot.
Yeah, it meant the whole class of probably things that were, you know, desktop oriented and maybe weren't able to successfully make a transition into the cloud, for example, or into a software as a service model. So those products were, maybe they were slow to recognize kind of where things were going. And by the time they got there, it was a little bit too late.
And to be a little poetic, Chris said, sometimes it's technology. So I'll say sometimes it's people. It's, you know, open source projects suffer from this as well. Like they just don't have people to have it going and the project just suffers in silence and then it dies off. So it's not always a deliberate sunsetting. It's just, you know, a consequence of not having anyone to work on it to keep it up to date.
Yeah, I think what we've seen a lot in you know, the modernization work that we've done seems to be a combination of, you know, the technology is outdated or it doesn't scale, it can't integrate, combined with, you know, usability issues or complaints from users. I've encountered multiple times where there's this like tension between users that have been using the old system and they're very efficient with it. But when they make new hires, it's really difficult onboarding, especially if that tool happens to be like a command line interface or something like that, where they need more technical knowledge to use, that you get into this tension of like, the folks that have been using this for decades are, you know, love it and it's really fast for them, but the new hires are struggling to onboard and get efficient with it.
Or so, even the people who have been using it forever and know how to make it work, you know, they're retiring now. And they're, you know, so now people ask, oh, how do we ever get that one thing to work the way it's supposed to? Oh, Jerry retired 2 years ago. No one remembers how he worked around, you know. There's some things that are that old where it's like, yeah, it worked well, we had workarounds, but that person has moved on or is, you know, switched to a different career or retired. Or so, yeah, I've noticed that tension too, Sarah, with products that, you know, maybe have been around a really long time and there are certain people who are really able to use it very well. But yeah, there's that growing tension where as more of the people who are super familiar maybe go and do other things and all the newer people are coming in and super confused because they expect it to work like Snapchat. Or like Facebook, you know, something that's, you know, very different and, you know, lower barrier to entry. There's that tension to navigate. And yeah, oftentimes the conversation is how can we support the people who are used to the old way while trying to gently nudge them toward the new thing?
Yeah. There's a lot of like, this is probably a dated term now, but a lot of people talk about the iPhone phenomena, where people that grew up basically with the iPhone and like touchscreen type interfaces have a different expectation of user experience. So prior to that, things were a lot harder to use, I think, in general, and people were less used to those types of interfaces day to day because they weren't walking around with basically a pocket computer. But once people got used to that and that became, you know, the main mode in a lot of ways where people interacted with stuff, their tolerances for old style technology or less than perfect user experience was a lot lower. And that caused a lot of sunsets because you either have to modernize or shift. And they usually just sunsetted products and built something new in its place.
Yeah. And I think it's also worth noting, yeah, there are different like reasons behind like just the who's calling for the change. Sometimes it is the users saying, this thing is such a headache to use, can we please get something better? And sometimes it's, yeah, from the business side, it's like a business decision saying there are security concerns there, you know, it's not performant anymore. We're running into compatibility issues with the latest browsers or operating systems. And we need to, you know, work on things because, you know, for whatever reason, you know, people are going to a competitor or we're, you know, getting all these complaints. And just so the request for that change can come from a number of different places, but the end result can often look like, okay, we need to switch to something different or sunset this and start something new.
And sometimes it could be sort of a marketing campaign type thing as well, right? I've seen this happen for at least food products. So let's take, you know, Taco Bell's Mexican pizza, for example, which I lived off of. It was my weekly go-to during college. You know, they sunset that product for reasons, and there were big protests and stuff, people saying, no, bring it back, how can you do this to us? But they went ahead and sunset it because they stood by their decision. And then, you know, lo and behold, maybe like 4 to 6 months later, it was a brand new reintroduced Mexican pizza that now costs double the price that it used to, and there was so much demand that it was selling out left and right. Like none of the stores had it, because it was always sold out with big signs saying, sorry, sold out already. And so it could be one of those where like you retired for a bit and then you build up the hype around it and then you reintroduce it, you know, with more bells and whistles and features and cost and what have you.
Or you rename it and hope people don't remember all their complaints, like what happened with Internet Explorer turning to Edge. Yeah.
You see geriatric rock bands doing this all the time. Like farewell tour.
Right. One last tour until then there's the reunion tour 2 years later.
Exactly.
Okay. So we've talked a little bit about the, you know, why this may need to happen. And there's a number of reasons. But let's talk a little bit about the how. When you do get to that point where you need to end of life a product, there are obviously some ways to go about that are better than others. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is where things often go off the rails, especially if you're trying to replace an old legacy product with a new offering. the same, you're basically trying to transition customers. He goes, what you got to figure out is how do you off-ramp the customers on the product you want to end of life and then on-ramp them onto the new product offering. And like all of those like barriers to adoption because of familiarity that Sarah brought up kind of come into play. You could also cannibalize your customer base and get them in a situation where, you know, one product is drawing from the other in a way that you don't want it to, at least at a rate that you don't want it to for onboarding purposes, or they may be reluctant to onboard or whatever, you know. So this plan is really important to figure out how to time this correctly and message it correctly and know your customers, because if you don't know the segmentation, it's really hard to coordinate this. But even if all those things are in place, it's just kind of the luck of the draw. A lot of times this is really hard to do. And, you know, the example that people love to bring up is New Coke and Classic Coke, how they like got rid of Classic Coke and just New Coke showed up and people got all worked up and there were protests and I don't know, people throwing Coke at like people going to work and stuff. And it was crazy. So then they had to bring back Classic Coke and maintain both of those formulas for a while. And then eventually they actually end of life New Coke. But like that whole thing is like a use case that people often bring up when they talk about offboarding and onboarding customer segments.
This episode of Connecting the Dots is brought to you by New Coke. Rest in peace.
As I sip my Coke Zero.
Right.
It was really disruptive when my local corner store replaced the Diet Coke in the fountain machine with Coke Zero, which I do not like. Yeah. So now I have to go to a different store.
Well, that's a great example, though, of like not knowing your customers, right? Like, I'm certain that Coke did some form of testing the formulas and they had some reason, like X percent of people say this flavor is what they prefer. But yeah, there's always mistakes that can be made there, or, you know, just not assessing the situation correctly. And yeah, listening to your customers, testing things rigorously, validating that the results are actually representative of things. And yeah, like there's a lot of work that goes into just like the user facing side of rolling things out. Because like you were saying, Chris, there's always going to be people who drop off in that transition, and trying to make that as low as possible is a big challenge.
Yep.
In a lot of cases, you know, if you estimate how long you're going to be in the sunsetting period, you're going to be drastically underestimate that if you are dealing with like a large customer base, like you're talking about, Chris, or like where you're trying to transition them onto something new. And I think of kind of like, friends who, use QuickBooks or something, and maybe they started on like QuickBooks desktop and some of them still have it because the cloud version's not quite at parity with the desktop version. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure people at QuickBooks are like, oh my gosh, for 10 years, we've wanted to close down the desktop version, but they might be making some money off of it still, but it's still just diverting resources from, you know, going forward. But it's kind of the same as in any sort of modernization where you say, oh yeah, it'd be great to replace this old thing with something new. And again, people drastically underestimate the amount of work that it goes into modernizing something. So I could see the same thing on the sunsetting side.
Yeah. Take into account the numbers, like the amount of people that you have, but also the loyalty, right? Some people are sort of diehard fans, and you sort of have to strip it out of their hands eventually. Mm-hmm. But that does elongate your transition cycle because they just don't want to let go. You know, Coke and others are a great example of this, right?
Yeah, and like software, especially if you get stuck, like having to support all local or old lineages of the code base because there's customers on it while you're trying to build a, you know, essentially what is a whole new product. That's always like a really tough scenario to be in, because you ultimately need two teams. The code base often diverges so much that it's, for all intents and purposes, it's two products.
Mm-hmm. I'm seeing these dual versions a lot with Adobe products where like, you know, they released a Creative Cloud version of Lightroom, which is more lightweight, and I think, you know, works on mobile, but it doesn't do a lot of the old school photo stuff that I'm used to. So it's, you know, they're still making updates and releases to what is now Lightroom Classic. And they have like these two versions of these products out there, but I see that in their kind of product suite a lot, just starting to have these, like, I guess, more geared toward mobile usage products, and then, you know, the desktop products that most of us are used to. Mm-hmm. It's got to take a lot of resources to support that.
Yeah. And sometimes it's not worth it. And sometimes it is. I know, I think I heard a story at one point, like when Microsoft was ready to move on from Windows XP, they had, you know, huge contracts with government agencies and military contracts, basically saying like, it is impossible or not worth it for us to upgrade and deal with all the potential like catastrophic downsides of that. So we will just have a private contract with you to just maintain Windows XP for us. And like, granted, that's a big enough customer that it's probably worth it in the end, but I'm sure, you know, that's probably not one of the things that was top of mind when they started thinking about, okay, what are we doing for the next release? Okay, it's time to end of life this. And then, yeah, all of a sudden you have a customer that says, no, we can't do that. Like that's not possible for us. That's not an option for us. How can we, you know, find a way forward? So yeah, you have those kinds of situations too, where you just like Ted was saying, you don't think about, oh, well, what about this customer? What about that customer? And I'm sure there was someone at Microsoft who knew that was going to be a huge hurdle, but I doubt they knew how long it would get drawn out.
Yeah, it's really tough, like, especially for things like operating systems where they build systems on top of it. And and that migration is so hard because they have all these, you know, all these products or all these, you know, tools or whatever that work on an operating system that cause them that they can't basically move forward because the cost of migration is so high.
Mm-hmm. So what can you do to make that transition as smooth as possible then? Because I think it's easy to talk about all the ways you could screw it up. Yeah. what are some ways you can, you know, take some steps to prevent the most catastrophic case of losing all your customers and the new version crashing and burning?
I mean, give them a viable option, which is easier said than done, but like, give them a path and then make that the transition to that path as automated and as easy as possible. So, you know, if it's a software application, they get, you know, the countdown that this thing is not going to be supported, and you give them in situ contextual links to things that are going to basically move forward. And that's the easiest way to do it. With consumer grade stuff, like, that can be challenging. With things that people have to be trained on, a lot of times you have that additional barrier, like, they're so used to it and the information is so proprietary and niche that, like, you have to weigh all those barriers to adoption. Like I said, it's easier said than done, but it's basically giving them a path and lighting the signposts with as much runway as you can possibly communicate to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think back too to the customer, like, knowing your customers too, like, recognizing in certain scenarios and thinking through up front and just recognizing and making the decision that, like, as part of this sunsetting, we may lose this segment of customers, and like, kind of understand that up front. That might be something that, just for whatever other reason, maybe you're not doing kind of like a, you know, next generation of something, but you're also just kind of reevaluating a whole suite of things, and this piece of it should go away, and we're going to move into this new area, and there's a little bit of crossover with the old thing. So some people, there'll be a transition, but then others just know up front, so you're not surprised by it, I guess. At least have an idea of, like, well, there's these people that use it for this. We are definitely not doing that. Let's decide right now. We will not even give anybody the idea we're going to do that. Like, it stinks. Unfortunately, they're going to have to stay behind, but we're going to move forward in this other direction. Try to make it a clean cut, at least, instead of dragging stuff out.
You have to be accepting that there will be some users that drop out. Like Sarah's Corner Store won't see her anymore. And that's just, you know, something they have to be accepting of. If you try to satisfy every single user, you're quickly going to burn yourself out and, you know, extend it too much, and the budget will be blown and things like that. So as Ted said, yeah, you just acknowledge that up front and be okay with it.
Yeah. And sometimes it's not viable as a product anymore, or it doesn't work out to be strategically advantageous for a firm to continue with that product. But there might still be a big community around it. In a lot of cases, especially in software, you'll see that people that run products a lot of times will open source them in that case. They'll say, we're not going to support this anymore. We know that there's a huge community around it. We want to preserve that goodwill. We're just going to open it up to the community and let the community run with it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a tactic I've seen employed a lot in software anyway.
I think that's a good way, yeah, like you say, to keep the good vibes to a certain extent. And there are some pretty mm-hmm. notable examples of that where people have, like you're saying, Chris, kept things going and they're still around. They would have been gone years ago. So
I think that's I'm thinking Janus Graph is one of them.
Yes, that is true. Yeah.
And as Chris mentioned earlier, right, bridging the gap, building that bridge that makes the transition as seamless as possible. In another podcast, I heard it summarized very nicely where it's introduce the change before you introduce the change, right? And so what that means is let people know what's coming before you actually make the change, and then let them know again, and then ease them into it. So for example, some sites that say, hey, there's a new UX user experience coming, right? You want to try it out now. And so let them try it out on their own without forcing it on them. And then they sort of get used to it. If they feel uncomfortable, they can revert back to the classic view and gradually they get used to it. And now you've made that process all the much smoother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That can backfire. Right? The thing I think of when you were explaining that scenario is Jira. Remember Jira like had all this legacy stuff and they're like, oh man, we're going to get people over to this next gen board. And like they like basically rebuilt Jira inside Jira to try to migrate people and no one would move. So now like you go to Jira and they don't call it legacy and next gen now, but like they kind of rebranded it. So they're for different use cases.
Yeah.
But both of them exist still.
Yeah. And that's the example I thought of when Sarah earlier mentioned that sometimes they're stuck with two products, right? That now they have to maintain like Adobe. And it's like, there's an option in Jira if you go and say, oh, go back to classic experience or whatever it's called now. And I was like, wait, that's still there? I guess they got stuck with it. They could like never retire because the transition, quotes, happened like, you know, years ago.
Well, and sometimes it's even a matter of like budget and priorities. We're like, all right, we can successfully kind of update and move over 75% of what we have, but there's a certain amount of budget and time. Like we can't, you know, the way I've most common seen it happen is like, oh, well, the most customer facing stuff is new and looks fresh and runs really well, but all of the like internal admin stuff is still janky and legacy and hard to navigate and never quite got that blow up. And that's I feel like fairly common for the stuff that's like, well, okay, we only need to use this feature once every month to maintain some, you know, scarcely used feature, but it still needs to be there, but it's not high in priority enough and it's not used by enough people to kind of need that much attention. It's just not worth it. So sometimes you see that also. It's like you kind of cut down the middle and you kind of accept the loss that like, okay, it's, maybe every screen won't look the same or there will be some things that are just slower, but the most important stuff is switched over and is seamless and works. So sometimes that's a compromise you can make.
Yeah, I've worked on a few applications where, and this is going to date me a little bit, but they have like, actually not that much, because I think this is still kind of the case, but this one web application had like 600 or 700 ASP classic pages that people were using. And they couldn't, and it's kind of that scenario, Johnny, where it wasn't super trafficked, but there were enough customers on it that they kept it in the product forever and they'd be there for that matter. And it's just like this kind of boat anchor that they took from one version of the product to the next. And just these certain set of classic ASP pages had to function.
Right. Or the jankiest solution is it's all in a new place on a new site and everything, but you have an iframe embedded with the old version somewhere.
I think that was the case here, if I remember right.
Seen that before.
Right.
Yeah.
It's more common than you may think.
You have a super modern React single page application with one div that has an iframe that has all these classic ASP components. There you go. You're modern.
Well, I feel like we touched on some of the mistakes that can be made or some of the kind of approaches, but are there any other things kind of around just making that transition that y'all feel like we missed?
I think we said this, but yeah, don't try to pull the cord too early. Make sure that the product you're developing is at least at par with sort of what the common user base is. And that goes back to what Ted was saying of like, know what the users are using and what they want. So like in Jira, what they introduced had really half the features that the previous Jira had. And so it was really an inferior product that the people were being asked to pay the same amount for. Right. So it just didn't make sense for anyone to jump over until all the other features were there. And that's where they really got stuck. Had they waited until all the other pieces had been built out in the next gen board, then I think it would have gone a lot smoother.
Yeah, 100%. That was a execution thing around rolling it out more than anything else.
Yeah, I think it's kind of the same as just the general modernization question, but I guess is how to go about modernization of something, because it just goes hand in hand with sunsetting the previous thing. But is, yeah, give making it so it's not like just for existing users, like at best status quo, but you're actually like getting some benefit. Or maybe the thing is even not initially going to try to bite off covering all the features you want. And maybe for a while, you're going to use it side by side with the thing that you're sunsetting. But it's giving you something, you know, net new that you're like, oh, I don't have this in the old thing, so I'm actually going to use it. Because if it's status quo or worse than that, it's kind of like, what's the incentive? So unless you have so many new customers who are going to come in and are just like blown away by the new thing, you're kind of in a pretty bad spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we probably implied this with a lot of the answers already, but, you know, involving your customer base and your users in that design process of the new thing and making sure that it's delivering what they find valuable and getting them excited about the new product can go a long way. I've seen that on some of the modernization projects we've worked on where, you know, having these key customers that they check in with often on where, you know, the modernization design is headed and doing lots of user testing and feedback sessions, so that you have, you know, a pulse on what the customer thinks of the new product, which I'm sure everyone is doing lots and lots of user testing everywhere, right? but not ignoring that feedback of what they think about the new product or just like the impact, you know, that transition may have on them. And then a lot of times those, you know, customers become the evangelists or the trainers of the new product for other people to adopt it in their org and their team.
I think also not acting decisively enough and quickly enough and looking for the signs that you actually have to start to ramp down a product. Like if you watch that demand curve, there's a lot of schools of thought that say that this is a relatively quantitative exercise to know when you start ratcheting things down. But if you don't act decisively enough, you're kind of on your heels when the product might start to decline. So you want to look at for those early signs, and you know, you want to end at the top of your game like Larry Bird. That's kind of the way that you want to end of life a product ultimately.
So we've talked a little bit about the different approaches, and I mean, we've probably covered pretty much most of this, but like there are a few different ways you can go about end of lifing a product. Regardless of how you go about it, we've talked about how communication and testing is all important, but you know, there's the approach where, you know, you change some things, but not everything, or you just move everyone over all at once, or you try to kind of announce it way ahead of time, give people the option to upgrade if you want, but you support a legacy version for longer, or maybe indefinitely if you get stuck with that. But I don't know, let's talk a little bit about just the ways you can approach it, how that can go, and maybe just some of the pros and cons of that.
I think we said this before, but I'll say minimize required behavior change, like make it so it just slots into what they're used to doing if you're looking to replace. I'm making assumption here that you're end of lifing one thing in order to capture the same or more customer segments with a new thing, but like just give them that exit strategy from one place and entrance strategy to the other.
Yeah. And if at all possible, making it, you know, as seamless as possible, you know, if it could be as simple as if it's a cloud-based tool I'm already using and I go there one day and it's the old version, I go there the next day and everything's updated. Yeah. There will be some frustration with, wait, how do I find this thing? How do I find that thing? But hopefully you've done your user testing, so you know how to onboard people in that process. But in the practical day-to-day of how do I get to the tool that I'm using? Oh, it's in the same place it's always been. It already works on my system. Maybe it's faster now. You know, it's a very different conversation if you're doing like an installation process on site, or you're, you know, having to configure a bunch of things for a specific customer that's different for the next customer, that's different for the next customer. But if you're in a situation where it can be, you know, as simple and automated as possible, that's a big win.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really, really hard to induce behavior change. There's a lot of evangelizing, training, marketing, outreach, all that stuff. And then even then, people a lot of times will have a negative reaction to it, even if it's a net positive from them. From a value proposition standpoint, just the fact that they get to do something different is disruptive. And so, yeah, the more you can streamline that, the better, obviously.
Yeah, so, you know, reduce or remove the need to do any sort of data migration by a user, or to have to do any kind of like rework. Like, it's one thing to be asking them to learn a bunch of new stuff. It's another thing to be like, oh, well, you know, we weren't able to move this piece over, so you're going to have to like go in and do it yourself, you know? So like you said, Johnny, yeah, have everything set up as much as possible. So it's really just a learning exercise versus not a bunch of extra work.
Keeping the minimum requirements the same. So if all of a sudden you introduce something and it requires an OS upgrade, then that's not going to fly well for a lot of people if you've introduced that drastic change underneath them. And then I guess for cases where change is involved, make it easy to sort of slurp in that information that you had before, so you don't have to go and set it all up again, right? For example, like iOS and Android do a great job of when you're setting up a new phone, you can point it at your previous account, whether you're upgrading on the same product line or, you know, crossing the streams and committing blasphemy, right? You are able to just log in with your account and all of a sudden it'll pull in your data and you are good to go within a matter of, you know, hours or less without having to painstakingly go and set up every little app and setting and whatnot.
I mean, and this is kind of stating the obvious, but I think it's where a lot of people screw up. Being real clear about the benefits, the reasons why things are end-of-lifing, and then being really clear about if there is something that you're trying to migrate people to, what that benefit is.
Or even providing resources to say, hey, we have representatives available to help you through that process, to help you, you know, take each of those steps, instead of saying, there's a document out there somewhere that tells you how to do it, go find it. Or here, even sending it to people, there will be people who get lost or don't know what to do. So having, if possible, people to help walk people through that can make a big difference.
And also just saying, like, there's a little bit of getting used to XYZ, but you're going to be able to do this when,
right,
when you upgrade or move or whatever. Like, I've been thinking all day about updating my Mac OS version because I want to, like, sit here in meetings and do thumbs up and see things go off.
And I would add to that, Chris, like, what are the user benefits, right? As a customer, tell me how it's benefiting me. Whether as a company you have to write one less report or you can't find the right, you know, developers for it, that's really not my concern and not a valid reason that you're sunsetting my product that I'm comfortable with, right? So focus on me as the customer. Like, what am I really getting out of it?
Thanks for connecting with us today. If you have a complex software problem that needs solving, thoughts on what we discussed today, or ideas on what topics we should tackle next, feel free to reach out to us at podcast@experoinc.com or on Twitter @experoinc. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks again for joining us, and we look forward to connecting with you next time.
What I really learned is you should just keep Coke Zero and Diet Coke both in your machines. Or if you really want to go all out, get the Coke Freestyle and you're set.
Coke Freestyle? That's a new thing?
What? No, they've had that. It's like where you, it's the big machine that has all the.
The one that's
I worked in advertising on that launch. Man,
oh, really?
Aisle machines. Those were that
and
was
it
a
all
fun
just
product
sort of tastes
launch.
The same. Yeah,
because you get everybody's weird flavors. Don't get cleaned off of there.
Not good.
It's a fun idea. But yeah, it's like fun to be able to add like grape to your Sprite or whatever. But like, yeah, it's, I don't know. I'm torn on them.
They just need to do a little extra flush or something between.
It's great for like movie theaters and stuff, right? Where like people don't really care about the quality. You just need something to like slurp down their popcorn, like push it down. And so you can mix all the flavors and you can play with it. So it's almost a fun thing.
Yeah, you end up with that thing at the ballpark from a kid from when you were a kid. Oh, yeah. You had them put all the flavors in one cup and super gross. But
Sarah, you said you worked on the marketing push for that. Was there ever a suggestion of y'all need to have like a shuffle button or like a surprise me button?
Oh, yeah.
No.
I got lucky. Lipton green tea mixed with Coke Zero and vanilla extract.
No.
I don't think so. But man, that sounds fun. I like that idea.
It's the like, yeah, how brave are you button?
It's like, I'm feeling lucky.
I would press that button every time.
That's great.
They need like one really off thing in there though, like whole milk. Because like egg selection dog. They have, I don't feel like you could get anything that was like totally wrong.
Yeah.
But right. So you need at least
pepper
one.
Extract.
Yeah, it's like a real Russian roulette, you know, sort of
sriracha
thing.
Or something. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
that's
liquid
fun.
LSD.
Yeah, yeah. Just Homer's eyes going.
Sarah, you could have had like an "I'm feeling thirsty" button.
Ooh,
thirsty.
Trademark that and everything.
Man.
Wow.
What are you wasting your time here for? You gotta
get on it. You need to be on the fast food train.
We could open up a whole other wing of Experio for just like consumer food marketing advice, and it's just Kareem.
Love it. I love it.